Most folks know Denise as the author of the classic novels Storming Heaven and The Unquiet Earth, as well as her beautiful novel about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Saints and Villains, and other books. She became very well known in the year 2000 when she ran for governor of West Virginia on an anti-MTR platform. Denise grew up in the Black Wolf mining camp in rural McDowell County, West Virginia, and was profoundly impacted by that experience. She holds several degrees and has been active in the Episcopal Church for many years. She is also a public intellectual whose commentary has informed a generation and helped to shape the current tide of protest against corporate invasion of Appalachia. Denise, we're so happy to have you on the show with us today.
Thanks. Glad to talk to you.
Now, you'll be coming to Lexington to appear at the Church of the Good Shepherd on the evening of February 13th, and I encourage everyone out there to attend your reading. What will you be doing that night at the church?
Well, as far as I know, and I haven't talked to those folks for a couple of weeks, but I think I'll probably be doing a reading from Storming Heaven, I believe. They have a book group that has read that book, and so it'll sort of be like a book group, except the author will be there. And after the reading, I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions and answers and discussion, things like that.
Do you enjoy being on the road like that? Or
I do. I actually, one of the things I enjoy most is the question and answers, because it's kind of fun to hear what people are thinking. And sometimes people ask a question that you don't expect, and sometimes they'll have noticed something that I don't even notice myself, even though I wrote a book. And it's always kind of interesting to, one of the things, as you know, as an author, is that you sort of imagine people out there reading your book, but you write it, and then it goes out in the world, and you can't sit on people's shoulders, and watch them read and go into their heads and see what they're thinking as they're reading your book. So going out and talking like that is actually a chance to do that, to see how it impacts people and what they think of it and so forth.
Well, Storming Heaven came out in the late 80s, and to what do you think this book owes its longevity? People just continue to read, especially Storming Heaven and The Unquiet Earth, and I know so many students who tell me that they've been just profoundly changed by these books. What is it about these books that keep people reading them?
Well, I suppose in a way they're the heart of what I wrote, in the sense that even though they weren't my first two novels, I wrote one called Good King Harry, which is about Henry V, of all things, King Henry V. But these are the books that I wanted to write all along, actually. I wanted to write them first, and the reason I didn't write them first was because I decided as a first-time author I figured I'd make mistakes, and I wanted to make the mistakes on a book that didn't matter so much to me, I guess. I guess that's a way of saying that this subject matter really mattered to me. They're definitely the two most personal books to me. I've written about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Emily Bronte and people like that, but it's not the same as writing about where you're from. And so maybe that comes through. I don't know. It's certainly Storming Heaven. The fact that students are still reading it and that teachers are still assigning it and so forth has certainly helped its longevity, if you call it that. But I think they wouldn't keep doing it if it didn't mean something to them. So I guess it's just that there's so much of me personally in it, perhaps more than even in my other books.
Speaking of teaching, you're fixing to be finished with that, right? You're going to be able to write full-time pretty soon.
Well, that's the plan. So far, it hasn't worked out, but I've only been retired for a little over a month.
Right.
And I took a couple of weeks off just to read and relax up until Christmas, and then I had to do a lecture at Davis and Elkins College, on mountaintop removal, that took about a week and a half to work on. So I worked on that, and then the plan was to start writing. But the day that I gave the lecture was the day that air water went all to pieces here, and frankly, I just haven't been able to concentrate. So this is my first month of retirement. It has not worked out in terms of being a full-time writer. I'm hoping that can change here pretty soon. But so I haven't quite, it hasn't quite sunk in that I'm retired, but I am, and I'm hoping that, you know, my book production, before I was teaching, I wrote Good King Harry and Storming Heaven and the Unquiet Earth over a period of 10 years. And then in the 21 years that I taught, I only produced three more books. So, in other words, before I started teaching, my output was twice as great as it was when I was teaching. And I'm hoping that having more time now will help me return back to being more productive as a writer.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up the chemical spill that happened in West Virginia a couple weeks ago now, caused by Freedom Enterprises up there. You know, when they do get informed about disasters like this, they think about the river being polluted and things like that for at least a short time. But I don't think that on the whole, when we think about environmental disasters, we think about things like the psyche and the way that the people are impacted in their everyday lives, not even in not being able to drink the water that comes out of their tap or bathe in it even, but also how it affects just every moment of your life. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it is incredible how, I mean, you don't think about water until you don't have it. And you know, it's been a nightmare pretty much. And I think, you know, we are finally, we were in shock at first. It was kind of like being in a war zone, and you really can't do anything except, you know, hunker down in your foxhole, so to speak. I came back from being out of town, and I stopped on the way and brought back a bunch of jugs of water. And this is before the government or anybody had come in to bring us water. And you know, we were kind of handing them out on the block here. Got to make this last time. We don't know how long. And of course, incredible. You know, four major hospitals shut down, and I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think about. But you know, we're past that initial crisis stage. We're still. I just actually today picked up another flat of. We're calling it Obama water. you have to keep your sense of humor. But you know, they're giving out flats of bottled water on tractor, you know, off of tractor trailer trucks, and they're still coming in here. Some things starting to get back to normal. A lot of people, including myself, we started being able to bathe. The thing seems to have dissipated enough that it doesn't affect people's skin the way it was. But you know, we still, you know, I'm, you know, most people are not drinking it. Most people are not cooking with it. The long-term damage to this community is just incalculable, I think. When you think about all the young people now who are saying, you know, as soon as I graduate, I'm not coming back here. And when you think about all the businesses that will never locate here because of what happened, when you think about all the tourists who won't come and all the conventions who won't come, and when you think about trying to hire somebody to come here, to take a job, the damage to this community, and it's so sad because this is such a beautiful little town in so many ways. It's just heartbreaking. And it's not, you know, it's not over. They still don't know what's in our water. This is what's shocking most to me, is that nobody still knows what it is. And now it turns out there's another chemical that was released, and nobody knows what that is. And the company's saying it's proprietary information. I mean, are you kidding me? You know, you think people are going to go to jail over this. Well, I don't think so. I don't think. Our system seems to say, well, that's too bad, and goes on about its business. And I think we also here feel kind of forgotten in terms of, you know, not much attention. And when there is attention, a lot of it's negative. And it's just been very difficult. I feel like I'm rambling on and on, but it's just been, I guess, it's all pent up, all this sadness and rage and so forth. That came with it.
Yeah, there's so many layers to this story. But for me, I think one thing that bothers me is I think if nearly 500,000 people lost their water supply for this long in New York City, for instance. I mean, there would be outrage. It would be on the cover of every magazine and every newspaper. Yeah. Yet, because it's happening in West Virginia, it seems like the whole country and even the world has been conditioned to think, oh, well, those Appalachian people, you know.
Right. It's, you know, there have been a few, I think, you know, NBC did a fairly good job for a while of covering it. I think MSNBC, I think Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow have discussed it some, but overall it's not been discussed. And it's even, you know, I'm a liberal, but I have had to stop reading the comments, you know, if you read an article on the internet, like from the Washington Post or someplace like that, and read the comments, I've had to stop reading that stuff because, you know, these liberals saying, well, these people, you know, I don't have any sympathy for them at all. They got what they deserve because they keep voting these people in and stuff, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, there seems to be no recognition of the power that the coal industry has over our region and the power that the coal industry has over the politics. I mean, who are we supposed to vote for? Because there's nobody who will run for office and will have the money to run for office unless they're supported by the coal industry. So the idea that you can somehow fix this with elections is just ludicrous to me. And the fact that the idea that you would have no sympathy for people who are going through this because they're some kind of ignorant hillbilly or something is just outrageous.
Yes, it sure is. Well, you have done so much good work in helping to tear down those images and those misconceptions about Appalachia as a place and Appalachians as a people. And so I know that so many listeners out there would like to thank you for all that good work you've done. I certainly thank you for it. This is Hillbilly Solid. I'm Silas House, and we're talking to acclaimed author Denise Giardina today. Thanks for tuning in here on WUKY Listener Supported Radio. I'm really excited about a book you're doing, which is about your relationship with animals over the years. What stage is that in right now?
Well, I wrote a short version of it this summer, and sent it to my agent, and she said, and she kind of gave me the feedback that I expected, which is that it's okay as far as it goes, but you really need a lot more, especially about of myself, which is hard for me. It's hard for me to write about myself. There was more about the animals, probably. I mean, that I probably covered the animals pretty well, but I need to flesh it out more. And that was going to be my first project when I retired. Every day I say, today's the day I'm going to start back again. I mean, my problem is that with the distraction and everything, my writing time is usually late afternoon, early evening, that kind of thing. And instead of sitting down and writing like I should, I'm looking at Facebook to see what's the latest that people have heard about the chemical spill, and then I'm looking at the internet to see what the latest news report is, and then I'm turning on the news and watching it, and by the time all that happens, then it's getting late, and it's just hard for me to concentrate, and I just need to sit down and block, you know, not turn the TV on, not turn the computer on, and just sit down and get back to the book. What I'm planning to do is. I actually have gone back and fleshed the first three chapters. I have expanded, and I did that before the chemical spill. And so I need to now get back to chapter four and just I've got some notes that I took during the school year when I didn't have time to write, but remembering different times of my life and things like the Vietnam War when I was in college and some of the early activist stuff I did in terms of. Land ownership in Appalachia and things like that. And so I need to bring all that kind of stuff into the story. And what I'm trying to do is use the animals as kind of the connecting thread, but to use them to tie in some of this other stuff too. So it's you know, writing nonfiction is not as much fun for me as fiction, but I feel like at my age, I'm 62 years old, and I have some of these memories that I should probably get down on paper while I can. And I'm researching a new novel, but I'm not ready to write it yet. So I think this is a good project for me to be doing in the meantime.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it. And I know lots of other people can't too. We have a lot of animal lovers out there listening to us right now, so they'll be anxious for that.
It's going to be a sad book in some ways, because each chapter is about a different animal, and you know, the animal dies.
Right.
it seems like that repeats itself like 15 times, which is not fun, maybe, but that's life, you know. And part of it is actually, it's been interesting for me to note as I write our changing attitude toward animals. Which I think is true in the Appalachian region, but also nationally. And, you know, I mean, my parents' generation, you know, animals did not come in the house. And when I was a kid, that was my mom's, you know, animals. They were not in the change between that attitude and then bringing them into the house and then making them part of your family and taking to the vet and things. That's all new stuff. You know, cats never came in the house. Because they had no place to go to the restroom. Then somebody invented kitty litter, and all of a sudden, you know, changed the... I mean, I'm thinking, you know, cats everywhere should... Probably the patron saint of... And I can't remember the man's name. It's in the book, and I've forgotten it. But he invented kitty litter. And, you know, they probably say a prayer every night. Thank you, yes. Mr. Wife.
They owe him a great debt for their warmth right now. I know that you recently read a book that I loved about Gerard Manley Hopkins. Called Exiles by Ron Hanson.
Yeah, that was a couple of books ago, and that was an excellent. That's an excellent book, very moving, about some German nuns who die in a shipwreck, and it kind of flashes back and forth between them. And Hopkins, and he wrote one of his great poems about them, it's a very moving book.
Yes. Yeah, I encourage everyone to read it that's interested in religiosity and spirituality and belief and doubt and all those things. Poetry, yeah. Well, again, I can't thank you for all the good work that you've done for our region, for our country, and I thank you for joining us on Hillbilly Solid. We are all sending our good energy and everything over the hills and hollers to you in West Virginia, and hoping that there'll be some justice there someday soon.
Yeah, hope so.
We will see you in Lexington on February 13th when you appear at Church of the Good Shepherd, and we'll all be there.
Great.